It's Friday, which means it's time for a look back at all the news that made headlines around the area with our reporter roundtable, Kevin Richert with Idaho Education News and Kimberly Crusi with the Associated Press of Idaho. Join me live in studio. And normally, you know, it's a Friday before Memorial Day. You would think there's nothing going on. And then, boom, big announcement. Chuck Staben, the University of Idaho president, will not be coming back after next year. Just came down from the State Board of Education saying they will not be renewing his contract. Kevin, one more piece of this, like, moving puzzle with university presidents in Idaho.
Yeah, I feel like I should be doing, like, one of those teletype ticker sound effects here. Because this really broke an hour ago and very abruptly and with not a lot of explanation as to the underlying reasons why. Chuck Staben put out a letter, his Friday letter, mm-hmm. to the university community and talked a lot about what this did not involve. He said that this had nothing to do with the sexual assault investigations that have been going on surrounding the athletic department. He talked in some terms about athletics and the move out of the move to the Big Sky Conference, mm-hmm. but allowed that his job search and the fact that he was a finalist for the job at the University of New Mexico was a distraction. But he really didn't talk much about what's happening here. Neither did the state board. So the news today raises a lot of questions and you know, raises more questions than it answers.
Right. In fact, the State Board of Education said that, you know, we wish him well. This is a mutual decision. That's what he said in the Friday letter. And as you said, Kevin, he said, and I'm quoting from his Friday letter, "My candidacy for another position in fall 2017 caused a distraction." And he said, once he goes on to say, "Some may wonder whether this decision is related to recent well-publicized sexual misconduct issues in our athletics department. This decision is not connected to our ongoing review of such issues." And he says that review is proceeding and a report will be available soon. There's no way, though, that people aren't going to ask those questions.
I think those are the first questions that are going to pop into people's minds, you know, especially the sexual misconduct investigations going on the campus with the athletic department. That is really serious, especially in the climate of
the Me Too movement. Right.
This is a very serious issue, and it's cast a cloud over the entire university, right, and not just the athletics department. So that's the logical question people are going to ask when they see this kind of an announcement that comes, with no other explanation, with no other, mm-hmm. Logical explanation as to why this happened and why it's happening now.
Right. And I mean, and so that people are aware, there's been kind of rumblings of Staben potentially leaving. I mean, we've all in this industry, we've all kind of heard those rumors.
But right. And the New Mexico search happened and unfolded before the sexual misconduct story broke on campus. That was several months before. So you have to keep that timeline in mind.
And Staben got so much negative pushback from his decision to leave the current football league they're in to go to Big Sky. Mm-hmm. So, but you're right. There are so many questions about that. And in fact, we wanted to, our Jimmy Dawson did an interview with President Staben a couple of months ago, asking him about how long he would want to stay. Because if you remember, and I want to quote this from when he took over his role on in March of 2013, he said, and this is a quote, "I am 55 years old, so I figure I've got 10 or 15 years of work left in me, and my wife hates to move. This is one last good job." Here's what he says to Jimmy, our Jimmy Dawson, just about 3 months ago in an interview.
"I'm at the U of I, and I'm certainly hopeful that I can stay through 2025, which is what I initially expressed.
What's interesting to me about that comment, though, is he interviewed at University of New mm-hmm. Mexico in 2017.
Right.
So it brings up all kinds of just questions about what's next for the university.
It does. And, something you have to keep in mind, we've seen, with Boise State, we've seen Bob Custer stay as president for 15 years. Mm-hmm. That is a very long run for a university president. That is not the norm. That's the exception. So for a university president to be leaving under any circumstance after 5 years is not that unusual. Much has been made about the fact that there's been a lot of turnover at the helm at the University of Idaho, that, this is another president's search at the U of I, and it seems like this happens every few years. Well, you know what? It happens every few years at a lot of institutions, mm-hmm. Regardless of what forces are at play. So this isn't that unusual. The timetable I wouldn't read a whole lot
right.
into.
And in full disclosure, I actually worked for the University of Idaho for 4 years. I did work with President Staben. I also worked with President Duane Nelles. Just want to full disclosure about that you know, I was part of their communications department for a time. I'm speaking with Kevin Richert with Idaho Education News and Kimberly Crucey with the Associated Press of Idaho. The other big news happened last Friday, which was the State Board of Ed saying we aren't hiring one of the three finalists at Boise State University for president. And now we're in a search for an interim president. Let's talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
Because once again, I think everyone expected when the State Board of Ed came out with a news release last Friday morning that they'd made a decision and would announce who the next president would be.
Well, that was the plan. That was what the State Board was saying leading into that meeting. You know, that they were going to interview the finalists in executive session on Wednesday. They were going to reconvene, have another executive session that following morning, and then go into open session. And I asked the board, well, does that mean that an announcement is going to come on Thursday? And they said, yeah. Well, an announcement came, but it wasn't the announcement that anybody was expecting, that they were going to essentially start the search over. And, you know, there's been a lot of buzz in the Boise community about this president search, and it hasn't been all favorable. There's mm-hmm. been a lot of rumbling and a lot of dissatisfaction or consternation about the field of finalists. I don't think there was not a lot of enthusiasm that I was picking up in the community about any of these finalists. So the fact that the State Board is pressing the reset button here and starting over, there isn't a lot of outcry about that decision. I think there are folks in the community who are probably saying, well, that may be for the best. Let's see what we get the second time around mm-hmm. with a new search that you can begin in the summer as opposed to beginning it right smack dab in the middle of the school year like they had to do this first time around.
And Kimberly, were you surprised by that announcement last week when it came out that there really wasn't an announcement?
Yes, but announcements about non-announcements are right. always, they raise a couple questions. I'm always struck by the cost of this. I mean, mm-hmm. these are costly, mm-hmm. big decisions like these means that you have to hire consultants, headhunters sometimes, or have the contracts, just the time alone. So hitting the restart button on this means that they're going to have to hit the restart on funding all of this mm-hmm. as well. And I think you guys had this.
You talked about this.
Our clerk Corbin had a story that he broke on Thursday about the BSU search so far. And the cost for the search process comes in at about $100,000. And that's just for the search that didn't bring in a president. So now you resume the search and presumably you spend maybe about that much money the second time around. You do have to keep it into some perspective, though. $100,000 is a lot of money. But the next president at Boise State, if he or she is paid roughly what Bob Custer was paid, probably going to make about $400,000 mm-hmm. a year. So within the context of filling a $400,000 or so a year job, $100,000 search, you know, I think you do need to keep those numbers into some perspective.
But then there's that argument that the cost of tuition keeps going up, right? And then you spend $100,000 on a search. Now you're going to spend another $100,000. That's tough to swallow, I think, for some people who are looking at the cost of education.
I think if you're a parent and you're paying higher fees, or if you're a parent watching your student take out more debt or a student taking out more debt, $100,000 job search times two probably isn't going to sit real well.
I want to switch gears a little bit. Kevin, you were at an education writers conference down in L.A. last week. You were kind enough to call in from sunny California.
But it was sunny. It was beautiful.
It was beautiful. Very nice. I want you to talk a little bit about a panel that you went to. And these were student activists and what they talked about.
Right. It wasn't all sun and networking. Probably the most powerful panel of the 3 days was hearing from four student activists who have become activists on the gun control issue, on the school violence issue, in the wake of what they've seen in their communities. So we're David Hogg and Emma mm-hmm. Gonzalez, who have been
from
so prominent in the debate over school safety in the aftermath of February 14th in Parkland. Alex King, a student from Chicago, where gun violence is, sadly, it's as he puts it, we don't have school shootings. We have daily shootings. I mean, that's his environment in Chicago. And another student, Jackson Middleman from Newtown, Connecticut. He was not a student in Sandy Hook on December 14th of 2012. He was in the intermediary school. He talked about the lockdown and the fear that he felt during this four-hour lockdown, not knowing what's going on, and talked about the door flying open to the orchestra room where he was in lockdown and the kids in the classroom going hysterical because they assume that you know, the door is opening and an armed attacker is coming in. It was actually law enforcement coming in. Listening to these students talk about how this has affected their lives was really powerful and really moving. And, you know, regardless of where you find yourself on the issue of gun control, you have to be moved by the passion and the eloquence of these students talking about how this has affected their lives and become a defining point in their lives, that it's not an issue that's just going to go away for them because they've experienced it. So this was Thursday, a week ago Thursday, and David Hogg, one of the Parkland students, talked about what keeps him up at night is the knowledge that there are kids who are going to go to sleep tonight and are going to die tomorrow, not knowing what's happening and not thinking about the school violence issue. And, of course, that was Thursday morning. Friday morning we had the horrible events in Santa Fe, Texas. I mean, those comments were chilling on Thursday. They were prescient and even more chilling in retrospect. It was a very powerful panel. As a reporter, you know, it's one of those times as a reporter, it's tough to take notes because it is just so, you know, you're listening and you're so attentively listening. It's like, I have to write that down. That's really important. That's really powerful. And I had to go back and listen to some of it when I got back this week just to kind of hear it and get the quotes and get more of the context. It was very powerful.
And Kimberly, you were telling us about an article in the Coeur d'Alene Press regarding students and what they're doing there.
So as school shootings are happening across the country, Idaho has been, I guess this is an odd thing to say, lucky that we haven't had one yet. However, that doesn't mean our students are immune, and they are consuming what's going on across the nation. And so there was an article in the Coeur d'Alene Press just this week where several students were recognized for building a bulletproof desk. And they said that this was because of they wanted to help their students, and this was one way for them to do it. And these were three very bright young girls who were in, I believe, high school or maybe middle school, and they learned how to shoot so they could test out their desk. Then they talked to law enforcement to figure out the best way to stop or maybe even to slow down a bullet. And I was really struck by just the casualness of just saying of they're like, yeah, like this is happening. So this is.
So here's what we have to do.
Yeah. And we just thought we could help.
Yeah.
So and it's just, you kind of talk about, I'm reminded of the student walkout that happened in the state capitol earlier this year during the legislative session. The students there, they are not talking about, well, Idaho has been immune. They're saying this is going to happen here in Idaho. We are. And it's going to happen to us. And so, Kevin said.
Well, and one of your colleagues with the Associated Press wrote a story earlier this week looking at the 10 most deadly school shootings. 9 of them have occurred in small towns or small cities. This idea that this can't happen in a community is nonsensical. It's happening in the communities where it, quote unquote, can't happen.
Our reporter roundtable is in full swing. My guests today include Kimberly Crucy with the Associated Press of Idaho and Kevin Richert with Idaho Education News. Kimberly, let's talk about Medicaid expansion and where we're at with this. But first, for people who haven't necessarily been following this, can you give us just a brief background on this?
Yeah, so Idaho has the opportunity under the Affordable Care Act to expand Medicaid that would allow roughly about 62,000 Idahoans to have access to medical health care coverage. But our state lawmakers in the Republican-dominant state house have refused to do so for years. After years of getting blocked of even having the discussion in the state house, advocates have said, you know what? Let's take this issue directly to the people. And so they, for the past, I think they started collecting signatures several months ago, started last year. And they submitted, it was a big grassroots effort. They submitted the signatures to the county clerks to be verified. Just yesterday, Ada County Deputy Chief Clerk Phil McGrain said that they have cleared roughly 58,000 signatures. They needed 56,000. So they have cleared the total They cleared the one of two key hurdles.
Okay, so this was the first one, which is the 58,000 or 56,000 signatures they needed, so, and they had to get them all verified.
It's kind of complicated, so stick with me.
Okay.
So the first part is just getting the 56,000 verified signatures. These are actual registered voters who have signed that are actual real people, and we have verified it. The second part is that you need 6% of registered voters in 18 out of Idaho's 35 legislative districts. That basically means you can't just go down to Boise and collect 56,000 signatures. You have to go in across the state. State lawmakers put that requirement in to make sure that there's enough support across the state
A place like Boise, let's be completely honest, can't dominate what happens in the state house.
Totally. So we know that the state has – or the organizers behind this effort have cleared the first hurdle. It'll be up to the Secretary of State's office to determine whether or not they have met the requirements of that second hurdle. That won't take place until after June, honestly, because they have until June 30th to finish verifying signatures. They are still verifying signatures, and they will continue to do so. And then the Secretary of State's office has until July 6th. So maybe it'll be a 4th of July.
Yeah, right.
announcement.
So even though they've cleared that hurdle with needing 56,000 verified signatures, they've gotten more than that. We know they've verified at least 58,000.
I also don't want to downplay the significance of just meeting that first hurdle. We have seen previous efforts to get ballot initiatives on the November ballot, and they have failed tremendously because it is so difficult to get enough signatures. People forget that they're not registered to vote, or they think that they've registered but their registration isn't up to date. So signatures get thrown out all the time. And so to actually get enough and then to exceed it, this is a big moment for this effort. And they work their butts off to make sure they get there.
And so can they take, as long as they're verified signatures, even though they only needed the 56,000, can they take the 58,000 to the Secretary of State's office? So they can. So in order to meet that, I think that would, you know, to make sure that you meet
that. It's going to be a fun balance for the Secretary of State's office to wade through. I just, in comparison, if you don't mind, there's a second ballot initiative effort underway. It's to legalize instant horse racing.
Yes.
And so I asked Phil McGreen how many signatures that they've verified with that. And they estimated that they've verified around 29,000. So not quite, but still, they have plenty of time until June 30th. They're still wading through signatures. Mm-hmm. But again, I think this just kind of speaks to the Medicaid folks. They were getting them in as early as possible, and they submitted a ton of signatures.
And then, so if they get over that second hurdle, then it goes onto the ballot in November?
On the Idaho ballot. Yeah.
And same with the instant horse racing, if they clear that as well. So we could see those.
Yes, we could have two. And I think both those issues will be fascinating to see how that plays into the November elections with the governor's race, legislative races. We could see a bunch of people getting out to vote for those particular issues. When I went to vote for my primary election, there were two voters that were asking, hey, I want to vote for the horse raising initiative. Where can I get that ballot?
They said, well, maybe
back in November.
Yeah. Yes. Well, and I was going to ask, so how does that play into what our gubernatorial candidates feel about Medicaid expansion? Raul Labrador, who's no longer in the running for that, had made a comment that he would potentially, even if voters passed it, may not go through with it. But with Brad Little and Paulette Jordan, what is their what have they talked about this much?
Both Paulette and Brad have so Brad Little is the Republican nominee, Paulette Jordan is the Democratic nominee for governor, and both of them have said we will respect the will of the voters. Paulette has actually signed it. She went and canvassed signatures. She was an active supporter, early supporter of this effort. I believe Brad Little said in an interview recently that he was still unsure whether or not he would vote in favor of it if it makes it on the November ballot. But they're in strong support. Now, we will see how outside money, because there's a lot of people here, a lot of Republicans here in Idaho that love campaigning. Like, hey, don't get that outside liberal money that's coming from California and New York. We're Idaho. So if we do have a Medicaid expansion ballot, we might be seeing some big money coming in and helping to get, you know, enough support on that. And that might backfire.
And maybe more voters out?
It could affect turnout. But on the money aspect, yeah, if you have money coming in on this initiative and you may well see outside money coming in the gubernatorial race, it could be a very it could be a very different electoral landscape, a very different campaign landscape leading up to November than what we've seen in the past.
I'm speaking with Kevin Richert with Idaho Education News and Kimberly Crucey with Associated Press of Idaho. One more topic we can get to. And Kimberly, this is a story that you did recently focusing on how almost all the statewide candidates who are running for open seats will see a big boost in their pensions if they're elected.
Yeah.
Can you talk about this?
So Idaho has this special exemption that we give state lawmakers. If you are a state lawmaker, unlike a regular state employee who you need to be in the state system for 5 years to be vested, state lawmakers just need 5 months to get vested to be take part of the state's special pension.
Yeah, their pension plan that they get when they retire.
So normally, if you're just a state lawmaker, though, it's a part-time job, and so you get paid part-time work, $16,000-$17,000 a year. However, under Idaho law, your pension is determined on the final 42 months of your career, the pay for those final 42 months. So if you are a lowly state lawmaker making
$17,000
and then you get elected, let's just say to an open state treasurer seat that pays $107,000 a year for 42 months, they will look at just that 42 months and then your pension skyrockets. So Julie Ellsworth is the Republican nominee for the state treasurer. This is just for an example.
Okay.
This is totally legal, but this is actually going to happen to her because she is running unopposed in this particular race. Her pension, because she spent 10 years in the state house, was going to be around $275 a month. Now, because all signs say that she's going to be elected, her pension is going to be closer to about $2,000 a month.
Wow.
So that's a big boost that a lot of state employees don't get. Now, supporters of this current system say, hey, we're getting experienced workers, we're retaining institutional knowledge, and this is a good thing to have. It's totally legal, and I don't want to – and this current system, it happens to everyone. Brad Little is going to see a big boost because the lieutenant governor, if he's elected, again, this is all
– So with this
– and it's not just legislators who are elected to higher office.
Okay,
it's also legislators who are appointed to run a state agency can see a similar spike in their pension.
And what I was going to ask, too, is this for anyone, though, who works in the state system and who gets – a job somewhere else, or is it just elected officials where this caveat?
The focus comes on state lawmakers because it's considered part-time, and no other state employees can have their part-time work count toward their pension.
Right.
And
okay.
So, yes, state lawmakers they love saying it's a full-time job, and it is. It is a lot. They're traveling the state for a ton, but this is a perk just only allowed to state lawmakers.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you guys coming in today. Always an interesting conversation. My guests today have been Kevin Richert with Idaho Education News and Kimberly Crucey with the Associated Press of Idaho.